a Hashimi. And so Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam, he talked about how even though this individual was not a Hashimi, but he has been given knowledge, and via that knowledge he has defended the Ahlul Bayt. And so Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam pretty much said that this idea that honor is based merely on lineage is not appropriate. Yes, the children of Lady Fatima Zahra, salamu alayha, that are known as Fatimis, and they're known colloquially as Sadat and Sayyids, those that are the offspring of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. These individuals, yes, they do deserve honor because of their lineage, but that does not necessarily mean that if they're evil people, they should still be given honor, even though it is debatable, because we find that in history there are interesting cases of even these individuals weren't necessarily good individuals, but they were given respect and honor by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. But really a discussion for another program. But here, just lineage, you know, if it leads to this supremacy, racist, ethnocentric type of mentality and culture, then of course it is most definitely wrong. But if it leads to a reverence, and a reverence not of that individual, but of, you know, who they are coming from, then it is allowed, again, with all of the variables that we brought up on the program. But here, Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam, again, he, more than lineage, what he does is that he gives importance and value, as he says, Allah has given importance and value to knowledge and to wisdom, and that Allah has honored those people who have knowledge and who have wisdom. Now, of course, this is a very important point, that yes, we should honor people that have this lineage of being Sayyids. It is something that we have seen in the seerah and the sunnah of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and it is something that we see in the seerah and the sunnah of the great esteemed and renowned scholars and the ulama of the Shia and of Islam. But more than lineage that holds respect and praise is knowledge, and so we too must be in search of knowledge. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The crisis in Niger is deepening further as junta leaders accused France of deploying forces in the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, as part of preparations for a potential military intervention following the coup on July 26.
It should be pointed out to national and international public opinion that since the announcement of this withdrawal plan, France has continued to deploy its forces in several ECOWAS countries as part of the preparations for an aggression against Niger that is planning in collaboration with this community organization.
The junta says France has deployed military aircraft and armored vehicles in multiple countries for such aggressive actions.
100 or so rotations of military cargo planes unloaded large quantities of war material and equipment in Senegal, Ivory Coast, and Benin, to name but a few. The CNSP and the transitional government denounce and castigate this lack of sincerity. These underhand delaying tactics are designed to dull the patriotic ardor of the Niger people in their fight for the total withdrawal of French troops from Niger in order to achieve a more successful military intervention against our country.
The statement prompted an immediate response from Paris. French President Emmanuel Macron stated that he would only take action upon the request of the deposed Nigerian leader Mohamed Bazoum.
If we redeploy anything, it'll only be at the demand of Bazoum and in coordination with him, not with those people who are holding a president hostage.
President Macron emphasized that France fully supports the position of ECOWAS, which has stated that military intervention is being considered as an option to reinstate Bazoum as president. Relations between Niger and its former colonizer, France, have deteriorated since Paris deemed the junta illegitimate. In the meantime, anti-French sentiment has been growing in Niger, with thousands of people regularly gathering in the capital, Niamey, to demand the withdrawal of French forces and its ambassador from the country. The developments in Niger come as people across the West African nation have been demanding withdrawal of French troops since the military junta took power following the July coup. This is sparked a call from the junta for Nigerians to persist until the complete expulsion of French forces.
This is why the National Council for the Protection of the Fatherland and the transitional government launch a solemn appeal to the great people of Niger to be vigilant and never to demobilize until the inevitable departure of French troops from our territory.
However, it is worth noting that Niger is not the sole country where anti-French sentiment has been prevalent. A glance at recent political changes and military coups in Africa, particularly across the Sahel region, suggests that public demands for the departure of French forces have played a significant role in triggering these military takeovers. Testimonies to this trend can be observed in Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, and the most recent case in Niger. In Niger's context, the country has been grappling with growing insecurity exacerbated by political instability and armed insurgencies. Moreover, despite being a resource-rich nation with a population of 26 million, Niger is considered one of the poorest countries on Earth, according to UN figures. Given the extensive involvement of France in Niger, both politically and economically, the general public there attributes many of their grievances to Paris. One may wonder why Niger has long been easy prey for Paris. Niger boasts strategic mineral reserves, including uranium, gold, and crude oil, among others. Notably, France holds mineral rights for uranium mining, which fuels its nuclear power plants. Consequently, Paris heavily relies on Niger's uranium mines. This has led Nigerians to perceive their country as a victim of French exploitation, with their resources being undervalued. Recognizing that other Sahelian countries may face a similar fate, African people are awakening to the reality that Western powers, particularly France, have maintained their presence primarily to exploit their resources. This realization has prompted Nigerians and other West African nations to assert that the era of colonialism is over, and they themselves must put an end to decades of Western occupation and economic exploitation in their countries.
Thank you.
A recent visit by a U.S. delegation led by Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Ethan A. Gorish to northeastern Syria has drawn outrage from Damascus. In a statement, the Syrian Foreign Ministry branded the entry of the delegation to the country's territory as unauthorized. The ministry categorically condemned the visit as what it called flagrant violations of Syria's sovereignty and a breach of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. That after the delegation, led by Gorish and a military officer, met with commanders of U.S.-backed militant groups, including Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, and tribal leaders earlier in September in the eastern province of Deir ez-Zor. The ministry said the delegation's meeting further exacerbated concerns regarding Syria's sovereignty and international legal principles. The ministry dismissed the delegation's claim that their visit was aimed at addressing issues faced by residents in Deir ez-Zor, calling it a blatant lie. It said the event underscores the hypocritical stance taken by U.S. administration. The Syrian Foreign Ministry stressed that U.S. is actively exploiting Syria's resources and capabilities while at the same time imposing unilateral economic sanctions, describing the measures as unjust, illegitimate, inhumane, and immoral. The ministry asserted that the U.S.'s blatant interference in Syria's domestic affairs, along with its extensive support for various terrorist groups and separatist militias, only serves to underline the destructive role played by Washington in the Arab country. The reaction by the Syrian government comes as U.S.-backed militant groups hold control to the east of the Euphrates River, while the Syrian government forces are positioned on the western bank. The United States also maintains military installations in the area, including the country's largest gas field, Alomar. The visit led by Gorish and a U.S. Army officer to Syria follows another trip by an American delegation to the country's northwest last month. The high-level delegation included three members of the U.S. Congress, Ben Klein, Scott Fitzgerald, and French Hill, all members of the U.S. Republican Party, who visited parts of Aleppo province with a claim of highlighting the ongoing humanitarian catastrophe there. But the interesting point about U.S. delegation's recent trips is that all those visits were made to areas controlled by foreign-backed terrorists and not ordinary areas. The recent visits also come in the light of Washington's all-out support for foreign-backed militants there. For over a decade, the United States has left no stone unturned to provide financial and logistical support to the terrorists, including Daesh, with the aim of overthrowing the democratically elected president of Syria. Reports on the ground indicate that the United States has recently increased its support for the terrorist groups in parts of Syria controlled by foreign-backed militants. Testimony to that is the deadly terror attacks carried out by Daesh over the past months. The most recent incident occurred on August 10th when Daesh terrorists ambushed a bus in Deir ez-Zor province, resulting in the tragic loss of 32 Syrian soldiers. Concurrently, despite the existence of U.S. coalition-controlled camps in Syria, particularly Al-Hawl camp in Hasaka province, which functions as a primary detention and holding facility for Daesh terrorists, the activities of the terror group have surged. Some Lebanese media have cited Russian officials that the U.S. support for Daesh terrorists in certain areas in Syria has significantly increased. Maybe that is why the Secretary General of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, has talked of U.S. plans to revive Daesh in an effort to justify its role in the West Asia region. All what it is that U.S. intentions to provide as much support to the terrorists as it can are not secret to anyone. But the real intention is, as the Syrian government has numerously complained about, to plunder the country's resources, including its oil and gas reserves.
A recent video circulating on social media shows Israeli soldiers of the Army's Golani Brigade rioting during a training session in protest against the far-right Israeli cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's recent controversial policies. The leaked video shows dozens of soldiers from Israel's Golani Brigade shouting and vandalizing property. According to the reports, several of the protest participants had been disciplined by superiors, resulting in the arrest of several soldiers, including sergeants. The regime's Golani Brigade is mostly made up of elite soldiers specialized in ground warfare. They have carried out armed attacks against Palestinians and have participated in almost all the wars waged by the regime. Ever since the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the proposal for the judicial overhaul, which limits the authority of the national judiciary, the public has held mass demonstrations across Israel. Tens of thousands of military personnel from different sectors of the Israeli army have protested against the decision, including 10,000 reservists from intelligence units and Air Force pilots. They have threatened to no longer show up for duty in protest of Netanyahu's judicial reform efforts. Last month, Israel's Air Force chief suspended a number of senior military reserve forces in the wake of ongoing demonstrations against Netanyahu's judicial overhaul plan. The development came a day after the Israeli Navy suspended two high-ranking reservists after they announced plans to end volunteer reserve duties, in addition to refusing to serve in what they called a dictatorship. Also, cases of suicide within the Israeli occupation forces have grabbed headlines recently, with observers blaming a mental health epidemic among soldiers. In July, Israel's Chief of Staff, General Herzi Halevi, warned that the army's unity has dangerously deteriorated due to the thousands of reservists who have threatened to hold service in protest against the judicial overhaul Israel faces. He also warned that Israel would be in existential peril. Some other Israeli military officials have warned that the reservists' protests are impacting military readiness amid heightened tension between Israel and the axis of resistance, including Hezbollah, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Hamas in recent months. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his supporters have rejected the reservists' protests as a dangerous and unprecedented form of political blackmail by the military, with some equating the protests to attempts at a military coup. Despite the threat of reservists refusing service, Netanyahu's far-right cabinet pushed ahead with the judicial overhaul legislation. The Knesset passed the legislation in a vote in July, despite months of large protests. The legislation struck down the ability of Israel's Supreme Court to veto legislation passed by the Knesset based on the criteria of reasonableness.
As the war in Ukraine lingers on, there are concerns among some Eastern European countries over possible peace talks between Russia and Ukraine. Eastern European countries are raising alarm over Ukraine potentially being pushed into peace talks with Russia. This amid hesitation and delays in weapon supplies to Kiev and waning public support. The countries bordering Russia and Belarus argue that international partners need to lay out a path for a decisive victory for Kiev. Some Republican presidential candidates, including frontrunner and former president Donald Trump, have called for the U.S. to directly negotiate with Vladimir Putin and relegate the war to a territorial dispute.
So we've been pretty consistent, actually, on all this. We need to end this war, no blank check. Europe needs to step up. And anything we do should be in America's national interest. You don't subcontract out your national interests to other countries. And I don't think it's been in our interest to be sending money to pay pensions for Ukrainian bureaucrats and salaries for Ukrainian bureaucrats.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has insisted that any deal must pressure Russia into a full retreat of Ukrainian territory and security guarantees. The concern comes amid calls in Europe to make some sort of a security agreement with Russia. French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna has said Western leaders will need to build a security architecture that respects Russia's interests when the conflict in Ukraine ends. Reality, history, and geography mean that this country is largely on the European continent. We will have to find a way to rebuild a solid security architecture that takes into account the stability interests of all.
Colonna's statement does not mark a radical departure from French policy since the start of the conflict. French President Emmanuel Macron has held since last year that Europe should discuss, quote, how to give guarantees to Russia the day it returns to the negotiating table. However, both Macron and Colonna continue to endorse Ukraine eventually joining the NATO bloc, which Moscow would consider an unacceptable security threat. Meanwhile, Ukrainian lawmakers have overwhelmingly voted to relieve Alexei Reznikov of his duties as defense minister. He has earlier tendered his resignation after President Volodymyr Zelensky announced plans to replace the official. Reznikov had held the post since November 2021. During his tenure, the defense ministry was embroiled in several corruption scandals. Senior officials were accused of procuring food for soldiers at inflated prices and paying dubious firms for supplies. One recent scandal involved a regional conscription chief who was charged with obtaining millions of dollars in illicit funds.
The money which is stolen or could be stolen from the state budget, this money is stolen from the war effort. So it means just like the soldiers on the front line, they do not receive necessary equipment or goods if the money goes somewhere else.
President Zelensky has appointed 41-year-old Crimean Tatar Rustem Umerov, who most recently led Ukraine's state property fund, to replace Reznikov. Experts have observed that the cabinet reshuffle is unlikely to lead to any major change in Ukraine's battlefield strategy. The dismissal comes amid Ukraine's ongoing counteroffensive against Russia. Ukrainian military officials claim their troops have made progress in the front line near the Zaporizhia region. Russian military officials have not commented on the claim, but they say Ukraine has lost a considerable number of troops and military hardware in the counteroffensive.
Yes, well, this counteroffensive has been much hyped for months before it even started. And I think it's fair to say that progress has been slower than hoped for by Kiev and certainly by some of its Western backers. It had a slow and sort of a rough start with a lot of Western equipment lost and Ukrainian lives lost. That's because the Russian defensive lines were really entrenched, very heavily mined, several layers deep.
Russian officials say Kiev's forces have lost more than 66,000 troops and over 7,600 heavy weapons since launching their push in early June. Defense Minister Shoigu says despite the colossal cost in manpower and equipment, the Ukrainian government continues its operation because it desperately needs to show some kind of success to its Western sponsors. Ukrainian officials have acknowledged that their counteroffensive was proceeding poorer than had been hoped and is being waged at a serious cost to the army.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Thank you.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and share with our guest speaker, Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome
alaikum
to the program.
Salam. Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. Let's start a series of episodes on, questions or of jurisprudential nature related to painting and sculpture, Sheikh Javid.
Sure.
Well, one of these questions that some individuals may ask this question, what is the view of Ayatollah Khamenei on making dolls and sculpture or drawing and painting living beings such as plants, animals, and human beings? And what's the view on selling, buying, acquiring, and exhibiting these items?
Well, this is a matter of controversy among the religious authorities. I do know some of the religious authorities who are of the view that making sculptures and keeping dolls in one's house is forbidden. But this is not the opinion of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. He says that there is no harm whatsoever in the sculpture, in the photography and drawing of living beings. Of course, when it comes to drawing living beings, that none of the religious authorities has forbidden drawing or painting living beings, animate beings. So, but when it comes to sculptures, making dolls, stuffed dolls, we see the religious authorities have different opinions. But His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that there is no harm in and making such things, keeping them even in one's house. And it's also not, there's also not any problem in selling or buying or keeping pictures and statues in one's house. And even there's no objection to someone showing these things or putting them in an exhibition, exhibiting them, putting on display. So because the time has changed. We are not in a, at a time living at a time in which people might
worship the idols.
Yeah, idols. Yes. Yeah. No one has such an intention. So
you know, calling them not unlawful is one thing, but what about this question? Are they like, I mean, all paintings and sculptures and such things as this, which we call it, reprehensible?
Even the His Eminence has not said that it is reprehensible. Mm-hmm. He has said that there is no harm at all.
Mm-hmm.
There is no
objection, no problem with it.
Making these dolls and using, keeping them, selling them, buying them.
Of course. Okay, in the new curriculum, there's a subject called self-reliance. Part of the subject deals with sculpture. The teachers ask the students to make dolls of rabbits, dogs, and the like from cloth or other items.
Yes.
What's the law in this matter, Sheikh Javid? What's the ruling on the teachers' instructions in this regard? And to what extent does the completion in full size of these dolls affect the ruling?
Well, as I said, there is no problem in making a statue or ordering another person to do so, because his opinion, his fatwa regarding these things is very absolute. It's not contingent on something or conditional to something. So he has said, His Eminence has said, that there is no harm whatsoever in making a statue or even ordering another person to make one.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, let's take a short break and we'll be back at continuing our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammed Javad, hosting this program, and Shaita, with our guest speaker. We're still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to painting and sculpture with Sheikh Javid. Well, what's the ruling in the matter of children, Sheikh Javid, drawing pictures of Quranic stories such as that of the people of the elephant and the cleavage of the sea for Moses, alayhi salam?
Well, there is no objection to it either. You know, it must be based on the truth, making sure to avoid, you know, dabbling in falsehoods and not to, you know, and make sure not to make pictures or draw pictures which is perceived or deemed as kind of disrespectful. Because some paintings, of course, look in the eye of people as disrespectful. So it's first of all, it's necessary to understand, to note that if a picture is drawn, that picture cannot be ascribed to those noble figures, because those are just those pictures come out of the painter's imagination. Mm-hmm. You know, they have nothing to do with the picture of the, for example, of the prophets, of Prophet Musa, alayhi salatu wassalam. So these pictures even cannot be ascribed to those noble figures, though we make these stories to just to help the audience or the children, for example, understand the story. But these pictures cannot be ascribed. For example, in this time around, there are people who paint pictures of, for example, of the commander of faithful Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. But these are not real pictures, and they should not be perceived as such. And they cannot be attributed to those. No, we cannot say that, okay, this is the real picture of the commander of faithful Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. Mm-hmm. No, we cannot do that. But okay, when it comes to...
But is it permissible to paint...
To paint, of course.
Uh-huh, it is permissible. Of the holy figures?
It is permissible, provided that it's not in common view considered to be disrespectful.
Mm-hmm.
It does not considered a kind of desanctifying them or violation of their sanctity.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I see. Okay. Sheikh Javid, let me ask you this question. Sometimes, you know, people paint, but sometimes they use some special machinery to do so.
Yes.
All right. Is it permissible to manufacture dolls or statues of beings having spirits like human beings by using machinery?
Of course, there's no harm. There's no problem in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I see. What's the ruling in the matter of making jewelry in the form of statuettes, and does the material which goes into the making of the jewelry or is used in it have any bearing on the ruling in that it may be unlawful?
Well, it is permissible to make statuettes regardless of the material used in making them. So statues can be made of any material, of anything. And
like gold, for example?
Like gold, but you know, of course, jewelry is used by women, okay? Even if it is made of gold,
mm-hmm.
there's no problem. But for men, it's forbidden to wear any object, any items made of gold.
I see. Okay, and a very quick question I put in here. Is returning the parts of the dismantled doll, such as hand, leg, and head, to it included in the impermissibility of making a statue, and could it fall in the category of making statues?
Well, just as I said in the beginning, there's no objection in making statues, buying them, selling them. So making limbs or returning them to their places per se is not considered as a sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
At any case or rate, making a statue is no, there's no problem.
I see.
In making a statue.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, and thank you, my dear listeners, for joining us, joining the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We leave you in God's care. Keep us in your duas. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, Whenever I remembered the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ard.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام وقيل له صف لنا العاقل فقال عليه السلام هو الذي يضع الشيء مواضعه فقيل فصف لنا الجاهل فقال قد فعلت.
It was said to Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, describe the wise to us. And he said, the wise is one who places things in their proper positions. Then he was asked, describe the ignorant to us. And he said, I have already done so.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, we are talking about the universal persona of the first divinely appointed Imam, the living, breathing miracle of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, rightful successor to the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him, Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib alayhi salam. One of the things that we find in this very beautiful, comprehensive persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and this universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, is this idea of helping people, right? To remove the grief from other people, to help other people, to bring solace to people, and to provide relief to people that are under duress, that are under oppression, that are under anguish. Now, wherever Imam Ali alayhi salam went, of course, this was one of the things that he used to do. He used to bring peace and comfort to those people who didn't have peace and comfort. Now, what's really beautiful is that it wasn't just in one limited place. So, for example, when Imam Ali alayhi salam had to pick up arms in order to defend the oppressed against the oppressor, he picked up arms. When it was time to help the needy, then he would give them food. If not food, he would give them lodging. If not lodging, he would give them wealth or money or dirhams or dinars or something like that in order to help them out, right? As far as lodging, they say that Imam Ali alayhi salam hosted many people in his house as guests, including Salman al-Muhammadi al-Farsi. And so this beautiful aspect of Imam Ali alayhi salam's persona, this aspect of helping people. So for example, he was well known, and he is well known throughout history and throughout the Muslims for helping orphans and taking care of orphans, trying to financially help widows, right? And of course, helping those that are disenfranchised, those that are in pain or suffering. And so we too, dear friends, need to try to find ways to be able to help the downtrodden and the oppressed people of our societies and our communities and the world in general, right? But of course, they say that charity starts from home. And so it kind of resonates here as well. We have to try to help those people that are primarily in our family, and then they are in our communities. They are Shias, they are Muslims that are in need, because nobody else is going to help them. It is our responsibility to start with our inner circle and then start to move towards the bigger circle. And if everybody takes care of their own and tries to take care of others as much as they can to the extent possible, then our society will move towards a very beautiful progress indeed. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and it's an honor to be invited by Brother Mahdi to this program. Today we're going to listen to George Jordak, who's going to talk about Imam Ali alayhi salam, and also about his book, Ali, the Voice of Human Justice. Let's listen to it.
لماذا كتبت عن الإمام علي؟ ذكرت الشيء أنا حكيت لك ليش؟ حكيت مطولا يعني. بعدين مجلة الرسالة كان في مجلة هون اسمها الرسالة.
There was a magazine by the name of Ar-Risala. The editor of this magazine knew I was writing a book about Imam Ali. Once he came to me and asked me for one chapter of my book. I gave him one chapter of my book, Imam Ali, The Voice of Human Justice, and he published it in his magazine, Ar-Risala. Now, at that time, the head of Karmeliyin Church saw my writings about Imam Ali on that magazine and liked it very much. He had very much respect for Imam Ali. So he told the editor of the magazine to come to me and ask me for the copyright of the book to be published by them. So when I finished my book, the Christian Church published it. After 2 weeks, they paid me for the book, but I didn't accept it because I didn't want to make money through the name of Imam Ali. They too didn't accept the money, and they also believed not to transact in the name of Ali. This was because we had very much respect for Imam Ali. By the way, they were happy with my writing style about Imam Ali, and that was a small gift of mine to Imam Ali. So I asked them to give the money to a charity organization.
Imam Ali كتير بحترمه بعظمه والكتاب عجبني كتير أسلوبه ولهذا الأمر هذا هدية مني للإمام علي فروحوا هذه المصاري أعطوهم لشي جمعية خيرية.
We invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Ali was even kind to the enemies. There are so many examples we have in his life, and inshallah tomorrow we'll discuss even more about it. But how was the attitude of Amir al-Mu'mineen in dealing with the enemies, let alone those who were friends? Look at the case of Ibn Muljim. And some of the young people have difficulty in understanding that Amir al-Mu'mineen knew Ibn Muljim and what is he and what are his intentions. There was a time when Ibn Muljim was there to collect the monthly distribution from Baytul Mal, and his name was also there in the list. And Amir al-Mu'mineen was standing there looking at the distribution of the Baytul Mal, the money being given out to the people. And he noticed Ibn Muljim in the line, and he says to one of his companions, "Uridu hayatuhu wa yuridu qatli." I desire his life, but he is looking forward to my murder. And so this fellow says that if that is the case, Amir al-Mu'minin, you know what are his intentions. Why don't you just arrest him? And this is where justice comes in. He says he has not yet committed the crime. Ali knew about it, not because of the normal channels of the spies and this and that. No, this was ilm al-ghayb. And we get this question sometimes that, if he knew, why didn't he stop? This is where we have to realize, and just to make it very brief, to have ilm al-ghayb is actually an extra burden on these awliya of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They are given the knowledge of the unseen, the thoughts and the minds of the people, what they have in their minds and their thoughts, but they are not allowed to use it when it comes to themselves. They can only use the ilm given to them if they have to prove the truth of the madhab or the claim of imamat. They cannot use it for their own personal issues. And that makes their imtihan, their test and trial even more difficult. It's easy for us to go through a difficulty and challenging, not knowing what is in the next step, next day or next week. But if you know because of the supernatural means of knowledge that given to you, still you are going through the natural cause and effect in life, that becomes even more challenging and difficult. And Amir al-Mu'mineen, you know, didn't do that. He knew, but he doesn't, you know, do anything because he knows that he's not allowed to use his ilm al-ghayb for such cases. Even when he goes into the Masjid al-Kufa, he knew Ibn Muljim was there with the sword. What are his intentions? But he couldn't do anything. Because you cannot punish a person because of the intention, especially if your knowledge is based on, you know, ilm al-ghayb and not your normal means of information. And this is where we see that the musibat of Amir al-Mu'mineen, that when he goes into the sajda, all of us go into sajda, and when we get up, normally we get up with a kind of a speed getting up. And you can imagine, as soon as Amir al-Mu'mineen was there in the sajda, and when he says, Subhana Rabbi al-A'la wa bihamdi, and after doing the zikr when he's getting up, Ibn Muljim was waiting for that moment. As soon as Amir al-Mu'mineen goes into sajda, he took out the sword, he comes to the mihrab closer to Amir al-Mu'mineen and striked it. He just struck the head of Amir al-Mu'mineen in such a way that when the person who was the doctor of the city came to, you know, check Amir al-Mu'mineen, he basically said that the sword had penetrated all the way to the brain. And the poison which was there in the sword had gone into the mouth. And so there is no cure for that. You know, when we hear about it, even then, look at the sense of justice and adl of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He indeed is the embodiment of justice and fairness.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Nearly all of the U.S. housing challenges are on display. Skyrocketing housing costs, chronic homelessness, too few homes to rent or buy. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Hill wrote in this regard, "Each night Barbara and her four children cram together to sleep on the floor of her sister's living room. Barbara is not sure how long this arrangement can last. Her sister and husband have two kids of their own and are worried their landlord will hear about them packing nine people into their two-bedroom apartment. Kevin and Samantha and their infant daughter fitfully sleep in their compact car, with Kevin and Samantha taking turns washing the baby while the other one works a shift at a fast food restaurant. They arrive early so they can spend time in the restaurant bathroom trying to bathe themselves. After she was evicted, Melissa lived in a neighbor's garden shed. The neighbor charged her rent to do so. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development estimates at least 500,000 people are homeless each night. That estimate likely misses as many homeless people as it counts. For most of Americans, evidence of this crisis comes from seeing the industry.